concern.
Yeah.
I want her to go see somebody, and it has been a venture. We'll use that word.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And we do have a quorum. We have a busy agenda today, so we need to get things moving here. And the first order of business is approval of the minutes of February 7th, which are in members' packets. Is there a motion? Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the approval of the minutes from February 7th.
Thank you very much, Representative Fisher. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes of February 7th, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. So the first bill on the agenda is House File 816, and Representative Hicks is here. And since she's not on our committee, the chair will move that House File 816 be moved before the committee, and it will be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And and we are, just so members are aware, I think we don't yet have the fiscal note on the bill, so in case there are questions about that. And so if I suppose any bill before the committee, it's possible that later on when we get the fiscal note, we might move it separately, but for now our intention is to include it in our omnibus bill. So welcome to the committee, Representative Hicks. Your bill is before the committee, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, committee members. I want to start by thanking Chair Liebling for her ongoing advocacy in this space. Currently, people enrolled in medical assistance services are either under a managed care system or a fee-for-service system.
And Representative Hicks, sorry to interrupt. In this room, the mics are really soft. If you would just pull it close, that'd be great. Thank you.
All right. Sorry. There are specific criteria required to be on the fee-for-service system, such as certification of a disability, SED targeted case management, cost-effective primary insurance, or adoption from the state foster care system. Currently, HMOs and county-based purchasing plans contract with DHS to provide services. The plans receive payment per enrollee. In the fee-for-service model, health care providers bill the state directly for the services that they provide to medical assistance enrollees. I want to be clear that our county-based service providers provide excellent care coordination and superb service to their members. And our MCOs, our HMO plans, offer a product to provide services as well. Under this bill, DHS must provide all MA enrollees the opportunity to opt out of enrollment in managed care and instead receive services under the fee-for-service-based model, if this is their choice. I want to highlight that this bill puts the choice in the hands of the person receiving care. Choice allows people to choose what makes sense for their needs. Choice allows people to identify what they need in their health care. Managed care plans offer a product to Minnesotans on medical assistance. If the product is not meeting the needs of members, this bill allows the option to choose a different product. Currently, the way the system functions, people cannot choose a different product. They can choose a product offered by a different managed care plan. I believe that this bill will increase the quality of the product the state is paying for from our MCO partners by allowing member satisfaction and product quality and the market to drive choices. We do not have a fiscal note yet for this bill, as Chair Liebling stated. But in last session, the independent fiscal note indicated that this opt-out bill will provide savings for the state. I would open to my testifiers to explain why they believe they deserve a choice.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hicks. And first person on my list for testimony is Idil Abdul. Ms. Abdul, are you here? Please come down. And then we're going to ask everyone to please hold your testimony to about 3 minutes. And we will time you, but we won't be super, super strict. But if you go much over that, we will ask you to wrap up your testimony. So So when Ms. Abdul gets to the table, I'll ask her to introduce herself and go ahead with her testimony. She knows the drill.
I do, and I'm going to time myself.
Oh, that's all right. We'll be timed. Don't worry. Welcome to the committee. Good to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's good to be back here, I think. My name is Aidil Abdul. I am a Somali autism mom and usually pretty pissed off advocate. Today I will say I'm happier because we're hearing a bill that's incredibly important. And I'm just going to read my testimony.
Yeah, and do please pull the mic a little bit closer.
Closer to me. Okay.
Yeah, it's the room. It is not you at all. But we have this problem every day.
No worries. Again, thank you again, Madam Chair and members. My name is Aidil. I'm a Somali autism mom and an advocate. Many thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of H1 House File 816. As you all know, Minnesota has a horrible and shameful racial disparities. This was shared with you by DHS's medical director, Dr. Nathan, who testified in this committee. This report stated 80% of people enrolled in public health programs are served by managed care organizations, MCOs. I want to share with you a quote from this report. There has never been any period in American history where the health of blacks was equal to that of whites. Disparity is built into the system. There has never been, and I'm a black woman when I say this, there has never been any period in American history where the health of blacks was equal to that of whites. Sorry, I forgot to put my timer on. And this was said by a historian of science at Harvard University, Evelyn Hammonds. You often hear the system is racist, there is institutional racism, the infrastructure is racist. Let's dissect this. The so-called system is made of people and policies, or rather policies created, enhanced, and maintained by people. This bill will move one step closer to dismantling Minnesota's systemic racism. It will allow low-income people who are forced into MCOs the freedom, the opportunity, and the right to choose their health care. Isn't that what makes this country America? Freedom is embedded into the American soul and fabric. It is a must that low-income Minnesotans enjoy the same freedom to choose their health care as much as high-income Minnesotans do. Data from DHS tell us that in 2020, 368 children with autism enrolled in MCOs were getting services versus 991 children with autism enrolled in fee-for-service. In 2021, 1,773 children with fee-for-service were getting autism therapy versus 696 who had MCOs. You see, Madam Chair and members, this is what systemic racism is. Michael Smith with fee-for-service gets services and therapy, while Michael Smith, who has the same diagnosis but has MCO, does not. How can anyone think that's right? The opponents of this bill will tell you MCOs save the state money. That is not true. For example, MCOs are paid at the beginning of the contract year, the full amount for the number of patients enrolled. In other words, they're paid for services not yet rendered, and most likely will never be rendered. So if you're fiscally responsible, I want you to think about that. On the other hand, fee-for-service is reimbursed after services have actually occurred. In summary, I hope you all support and vote for this incredibly important legislation for two main reasons. Number one, it will decrease racial disparities in Minnesota. It will save the state money because services that actually occurred will be paid for. I want to thank Representative Hicks, who is an autism mom. Thank you so much for doing this. And I want to thank Chair Liebling, who's always been in the corner of children with autism and their families. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate you being here. And your written testimony is available to the committee as well. So thank you very much. Dan Andreessen. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. We're the trade association for Minnesota's nonprofit insurers, which includes Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, Health Partners, Medica, Sanford Health, and UCARE. And many of our members operate as managed care organizations for the state's Medicaid program. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this bill, and I want to extend our appreciation to Representative Hicks for meeting with us on this bill, and look forward to continuing those conversations as this bill goes forward. As MCOs, if enrollees are having issues with one of our plans, we are always open to hearing what is happening, because we want to find solutions to those situations. We also believe that for a majority of Minnesotans enrolled in medical assistance, managed care is the best way to access care compared to fee-for-service. There are several benefits associated or offered by MCOs that are not part of the fee-for-service program. This includes supplemental benefits such as additional dental coverage, wellness benefits, incentives for preventative care, education on health and wellness, and notices when key preventive care is missed. MCOs help enrollees schedule appointments, arrange transportation to their doctor, coordinate medical care, and help enrollees access community-based services. A significant portion of the Medicaid population are seniors and Minnesotans living with disabilities. And care coordination is key for this population, so enrollees are not missing out on care and facing duplicative care. Examples of care coordination is listed in the fact sheet that's in your packets. The option to opt out of managed care is an option for certain Medicaid enrollees currently. And if this is expanded, we are concerned about potential confusion when enrollees sign up for medical assistance, and wondering what entity will be the one to make sure that they provide information to that enrollee to make sure they're making an informed decision about the benefits and impact of their choice. So we should be cautious about setting up a situation where a decision could result in a Minnesotan getting worse care because fee-for-service wasn't the best option for them. So we would encourage this proposal to be analyzed further. However, if it is passed, we would encourage analysis so we can kind of see what happens after passage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. Next, Omar Jamal. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Representative Dina. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Hicks. And can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Yes, I'm really honored to come and testify here today in support of this bill, 816. And I'm honestly with you a little bit, you know, kind of shocked, because I think American political culture has always been centered on the core of values, one of which is freedom, freedom to choose. And this is, it speaks nothing else than that. And I heard my friend said that if they have issues, we will listen their issues and their concerns. If I get a dollar every time I heard that for the last 20 years, I've been millionaire today. This issue touches the hearts and the minds of millions of people. Medical assistance does not exist for people for benefit purposes. It solely exists to provide health care. To provide health care to enrollees, we should be able to choose a full range of different of their choice. If your product is good, your patients will remain loyal. Here, I've seen a lot of people. I've dealt with all these HMOs in my life. I've seen them. I sit them with their offices. Beautiful, millions of dollars buildings. I sit across them. I heard them. I listened to them. It's about, this is simply, it's about the powerful and the weak. What's happening here, and it speaks to your own consciousness, to your own moral and ethics. This, the fork in the road. Which road will you take? And you are a stewardship of these people over there. You've been elected, and Tina Liebling, even though she's from Rochester, She has been the voice of people everywhere. I've seen her fight. She's a lawyer. She's an MS for health education. She knows, and we go to her office, to her house, for issues that we have. And I urge you today, this is way overdue issue. This is way overdue issue. It's not about money. It's about patients, people, sick people. It's nothing else. This should be the center of, if you are saying that we are stupid enough to make any decision, so we will make a decision for you, fine. We will surrender then. You think for us, we will not think at all. But if you think we are capable of making our own decisions, that we can do that on our own, we know what's best for us, we know what's best for our children, we know what's best for our elders, these corporates, believe me, I have documents, documents after documents after documents. I don't know what this country has come to. I don't understand where this country is going to. And I know that. I've worked with Paul Wollaston, God may rest his soul. I've worked with a lot of people. Whether you believe it or not, I've worked with Jesse the Body as a governor. I worked in his office. I've seen all this. And guess what? Now I sit back and say, you know what? American experiment is really coming to an end. The writing is on the wall. Yeah. What are the people we elect in the office are thinking?
Mr. Jamal, I have to ask you to wrap it up.
Okay.
Yeah, and also, if you could, I don't think Ms. Niedernhofer told me we need you to actually state your name for the record, if you would, and if you have an affiliation.
My name is Omar Jamal. I'm a longtime resident of the city of St. Paul. I've seen more than my share of this fight in this state, racial equality, all of that. And I'll tell you, I'll conclude this with simple things. What this bill will do is to eliminate discrimination enforced by the state, if you believe that. Reduce racial disparities, the freedom to choose culturally appropriate health care providers, provides good transparency, accountability for taxpayers. Accountability. Accountability. Corporates tell us that, oh, the way we do business is a secret, trade secret. We cannot tell you anything. We keep this. Washington, Hamilton, Madison, Lincoln are all turning in their graves. Top secret, corporate secret. So we will watch and see if your voice will go for the weak, the powerless, or you will empower them more and they will get emboldened and will continue to suffer under your own watch. I want to thank you very much for listening, and I will follow up with this bill. I really want a personal tax representative fix, and Tina's record speaks volume. In the hearts of the minorities. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I did not set that up, just so everybody knows. But thank you very much for your testimony. Steve Gottwald, I'm sure he doesn't have that same opinion. Just saying, Steve. No, former Representative Gottwald used to have this job that I now have, so.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you? My name is Steve Gottwald, Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans. We are a nonprofit association representing the state's three county-owned and operated county-based purchasing plans. For more than 40 years, CVP plans have been assuring access to quality, cost-effective care for people enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs. Our county-based plans currently serve more than 107,000 public programs enrollees in 33 counties. We respect your desire for meaningful change. In fact, as you heard from Representative Hicks, and we certainly appreciate her support and comments, County-based purchasing is a meaningful change that has improved access and care outcomes for people across rural Minnesota who need and deserve access to quality, cost-effective care. We'd like to support this legislation, but we do have some serious concerns that HF 816, as currently written, will undermine the good work of our county-based purchasing plans and the outstanding results this model delivers in the 33 rural Minnesota counties that have chosen CVP for delivering Minnesota healthcare programs to local residents. A little bit of background. County commissioners started county-based purchasing more than 40 years ago because of the failure of traditional managed care plans to address the unique needs of rural patients and providers. Legislators agreed on a bipartisan basis and enacted CVP into state law in 1997. Likewise, the prepaid medical assistance program began as a response to concerns about fee-for-service MA and a desire to leverage the good aspects of care management, network access, and cost effectiveness. We are concerned that HF 816's PMAP opt-out will erode what the counties and legislature have achieved with the CVP model and would inadvertently harm the access to care public program enrollees need and deserve. HF 816 would disrupt continuity of care management, as members could opt out and opt in with different payers. It would deter investment in developing local health care infrastructure and capacity that's needed to ensure access to care, particularly in rural areas where this is a really fragile infrastructure. Some providers may decide to no longer serve MA or Minnesota care enrollees, harming access to care for people. As you know, fee-for-service pays less than county-based purchasing office often does. We do that with the intent of trying to strengthen the provider network so that people of all backgrounds can have access to the care they deserve. HF 816 would make it impossible to do value-based care and payment in rural counties as the enrollee population would be further split with another payer. This undermines the critical mass of members CVP plans need in rural counties to do value-based care and payment with rural providers. And this is where we've talked with DHS. They would like to see us move towards value-based care, and I think that's the right way to go. HF 816 raises some important practical concerns. When an enrollee is one of our rural county-based purchasing counties and opts out to DHS fee-for-service, who will coordinate well child checkups, non-emergency medical transportation, dental care access, which, by the way, is the best in the state in county-based purchasing counties? There's a reason for that. We do a really, really good job of creating access to care for the people in our counties because counties care. We're stitched to the geography. We take care of the people that we represent. So that's a concern. What about immunizations and other needed services that CBP plans now provide on a locally responsive and accountable basis? How will fee-for-service replicate the close integration of county social services, public health, and other county services that members currently enjoy in CBP plans because we're directly integrated with county services? That's kind of the value-added benefit that you get from county-based purchasing plans.
Mr. Gault, I have to ask you to wrap up.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. In short, we're glad to work with the author, and we've talked with her about this. We'd like to work with her on some of these things. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on this, and I'd be open for any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Hicks.
All right. Thank you very much. And, you know, no words about the chair from you, huh? That's okay. That's all right.
Trying to be respectful, just, Madam Chair.
Just to be clear, that's completely unnecessary. Okay. Thank you very much. Next, we have Diane Peterson. Ms. Peterson, are you here? Very good. She's coming down. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record. Tell us if you're affiliated with anyone or just here on your own, and please go ahead and give us your testimony.
My name is Diane J. Peterson. I live in St. Paul. I am affiliated with Health Policy Advocates, and I want to thank you, Representative Liebling, for authoring this health care justice bill in 2022, and Representative Hicks for authoring it this year. Since 2015, when I co-founded a citizen activist group, Health Policy Advocates, aiming to improve healthcare in Minnesota, the problem of freeing medical assistance patients from managed care supervision has been an issue for me and my fellow group members. At a 2015 public forum, One of us asked District 64 legislators to allow medical assistance patients the freedom to choose their own doctors and healthcare providers. We knew only 25% of medical assistance patients were given that right then, and we wanted them all to have it. We still want this for them. Department of Human Services statistics show that in 2020, 18% of these patients were privileged with the freedom to choose their healthcare providers, but that shrank to 15.3% in 2021. While the state engages in discrimination against the majority of medical assistance patients, it also seems to be reducing the amount of patients who get the freedom to choose. Health Policy Advocates has named HF 816 the Freedom to Choose Bill. It will eliminate an unacceptable unfairness which deprives over a million Minnesotans from being able to choose the healthcare providers they decide are best for their situations. It is simply wrong for my tax dollars to maintain a privileged system alongside a non-privileged system in public health programs. I ask you to end the state-imposed discrimination against the majority of medical assistance patients by voting for House File 816, restoring the freedom to choose their preferred health care providers to all medical assistance patients. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thanks for being here today and for all your work on this issue.
I've been at it even before 2015, but it was in 2015 that the discrimination against medical assistance patients was uncovered by a friend of mine who had been under the care of an MCO, and she fought long and hard to get onto fee-for-service.
All right. Thank you so much. That's the end of my list of testifiers who signed up. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? And I'm not seeing anyone. Are you seeing anyone? No. So we'll close the testimony then, and we will go to discussion. And first, we have Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the calls for improving the health care disparities, health care outcome disparities on this bill, I hope would help us to also look at PGX, individualized medicine, so we actually get the right treatment and medicines to the individual instead of what the average person would do best with, because we all know people are individuals. In the testimony, they're saying that there's no savings from the managed care organizations. I've sat in this committee many years ago, and there was an occasion of where millions and millions of dollars were returned. It's memorable because it was being called a donation back to the state, and the Fed said, no, that's a refund. And we ended up having to give the feds their portion back. So when we look at this, have the merits on all sides considered. I like the county-based because it, when we're budgeting and looking at the costs, it's not an open-ended expenditure of where we discover, that there's 10% more expenditure than we had thought with the fee-for-service. If we expand the fee-for-service, and I'm not against that, we also have to look at the effects it may have in different locations, because the fee-for-service is often pennies on the dollar. And a lot of our rural health clinics and facilities, we have to look at the viability. So if they close, there's a lot of driving, and sometimes in the winter, it's not easy to go the extra hour or two to get somewhere. So on the intent, we have to make sure that we avoid any unintended effects and look at the unpredictability. That's why I was hoping we'd have the fiscal note so that we'd have a better idea and look at that. So I just want members to think at the details instead of, well, this sounds good, but when we implement something like this, we have to get the details worked out. And I think the bill needs a little bit more work before it's ready.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Quam. And I'm going to go to Representative Fisher. But I just do want to say that you were talking about what reimbursements are under either system. And part of the problem is under the MCOs, we don't know what the reimbursement is, and we have no control over it or very little, I would say. So that is part of the problem that it poses for us as legislators, right? We can be concerned about reimbursements. We know what they are under fee-for-service. We do not know under MCOs. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I do know sometimes what the reimbursements are, and they are poor. And I think this goes back to, I'll build off what Mr. Jamel said earlier, this is about the powerful versus the weak. And it's not just about those who are receiving the services, but it's also about the clinics and the providers out there. So often the small clinics and providers have no say in what is being reimbursed. I have seen actual rates that are spelled out in statute for reimbursement that the NCOs don't pay, and they pay substantially less than that. And usually the clinics that are being hit most in this area because they don't have the power to say anything are the small ones that are serving populations that are underserved and by large people of color. They are also the same clinics that are also providing some of the same services you heard the NCOs mention. They're arranging appointments, providing transportation for people to get back and forth, making sure they're getting linked in with the other services, whether it's dental or mental health. A perfect example, our federal qualified health clinics does a lot of work in this area. And so often the companies make it so hard to get reimbursed for services that some of the money that's being returned is because the services were provided, legitimate services were provided by the clinics, but the insurance companies threw up barriers so they didn't have to pay them out. And this is a big problem in the system. And so I thank Representative Hicks for bringing out what is a bill to start addressing this. I do know I've got a bill that's going a little bit further in this area. And I will say is the question I have is why and opt out instead of opt in. And the reason I say that, there are a lot of people who receive the services who are very mobile, and as a result they don't get to see the information to make the choices themselves. And having seen conversions and as NCOs change in and out of the system, how it's handled, most people don't understand it. And also most people don't understand that if the insurance is not paid for, they don't know they have to go to the Department of Commerce to get this done, and the providers can't do that. So you've got a lot of lost things in the process. So I'll stop there.
Okay, Representative Hicks.
Yes, thank you so much, Representative Fisher, for the question. And I want to be really clear. A lot of what the people who spoke in opposition of this bill today said is true. They do provide other services. They do provide, frankly, our county-based service does the best with dental in the entire state, especially for children. The reason this is an opt-in and not an opt-out is because I want people who are not getting what they need to be able to opt in to a different system, for them to have the choice. I think that's what we all want. And if you believe that your service is your product, this is an insurance product, is superior, there should be no concern that someone's going to opt out of a superior product into a state-based service model. If the product is truly superior, and the product truly provides the things that it is supposed to provide or that they advertise it provides, then no one will opt out because the product will be meeting their needs. That is why it's opt out, because they don't want to force people into another choice either. Opting in puts people into our system and says you must choose something else. And they may not know how to, they may not have the skills to, they may not understand that like this covers this and this doesn't. But if it's an opt out, they are aware that the system isn't working for them in some way, and they are choosing something else. And I think for us as legislators, it gives us data. If a whole bunch of people are opting out of a certain product, that has a conversation that we can all have about why is that? Why is that a problem? Does that answer your question, Rep. Fisher?
Okay. And you know what we do? And I just want to say we have three other members on the list, so maybe we should just, yeah, thank you. Okay, so I have Representative Carol Schumacher and Nadeau. Representative Carol.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative Hicks, for bringing this. This is an incredibly complicated topic in the subject area. I served as general counsel to Metropolitan Health Plan, the county's or the state's only health plan that was certified by the Department of Health as a political subdivision. It's separate from county-based purchasing, but it's similar to. So I appreciate what you're trying to do here. I'm concerned that by doing so, you will unravel unintendedly the complex fabric that is our healthcare system in this area. So I think you could end up pulling a thread that could just dismantle the entire system unintendedly. I think this is worthy of further study and, you know, insight, and I would be happy to work with you on that. I was impressed as serving as general counsel to Metropolitan Health Plan for 15 or so years, the array of services provided to folks in public programs, and the care navigators and all the infrastructure that helps support them. And I appreciate there may be differences out in greater Minnesota as opposed to the Seven County metropolitan area where MHP operated. But I appreciate you starting this conversation. I'd like to work with you. So right now I think it's we should take a pause on this and further explore it.
Yeah, and Representative, the bill is actually going to be laid over.
Okay.
So we're not voting on it today. It's going to be here, and I'm sure that Representative Hicks would be happy to work with you to hear, you know, get your insight.
Thank you, Chair.
Right. Okay, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hicks. I had a series of questions, but I think most of those will be answered whenever a fiscal note gets presented and we hear this bill again. The one question I did want to ask today, and really just more of a clarification or a restatement with this, is we heard the testimony about dental access, and Representative Hicks, you responded before that that's just a choice that people have to make, and if they want to keep the dental access that's provided under the MCOs, that they should choose to stay in the MCOs then. Is that, did I understand you correctly when you stated that?
So thank you for the question. So what I'm saying is that the fee for service system is also not perfect. It is not where it needs to be. That is completely not, I mean, it needs work, particularly in children's dental, particularly in medical transportation. There are huge holes in that system as well. But there are also holes in the other system. And what this does is give people a choice while we as a legislative body continue to work to fill those holes. Waiting until we have created and filled every hole to give people a choice is not, in my opinion, an appropriate solution. And that is why it is an opt-out, not an opt-in. I don't think we should force people into another system. I think we should simply give them a choice as to which system meets their needs.
Representative Schumacher, follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Nadeau, and then Ryer, and then we're going to lay the bill over. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, thank you, Representative Hicks. It's really refreshing to see you present this and be super open and kind about, you know, the positives and negatives on both sides. And some people obviously are really upset with MCOs. You know, they've done a really yeoman's work for a long time. And maybe there is an opportunity, you know, for some things to change, for more choice, for all populations. Who knows? But I really appreciate the way that you're approaching it. And I want to mimic Representative Carroll's, you know, thoughts and concerns. In my county, there is an incredible integration with social services that the county delivers to these populations, and I think it's vital that we hold those and use those as an example. Not all counties can be like ours, but you know it's it's important. The question that I had is I'm concerned with is DHS's capacity to deal with more fee-for-service clients. That has a tendency to be a bottleneck. right now. And if all of a sudden there's a significant number of folks who decide to go through there, the counties deal with it from the MCO standpoint. We're the ones that teach and help integrate those services. If they go to fee-for-service, that's on DHS's responsibility. And how do you think that they will deal with that additional capacity? Or is there somebody here that from DHS that can answer that?
Representative Hicks?
So if the DHS folks want to come down, they're welcome to, but here's what I will say. Mm-hmm. The fee-for-service network is already built. It already exists. Those providers are already enrolled. So when someone moves over for fee-for-service, for any of the reasons that I listed that are already outlined in statute, right, adoption out of foster care, certified disability, they get on Social Security, they become certified through the state system, right, the SMRT process, or they access targeted children's mental health case management under SED, any of those things will trigger a move to fee-for-service. That move happens in the system through the financial worker checking the box. If it's certification of disability, they move from medical assistance low income adult to medical assistance DX. In the system, it is MA-DX. Mm-hmm. That move over is within the system. And then for the person, when they go to their medical provider just changes who they bill. Instead of billing Blue Cross Blue Shield, they use the DHS fee-for-service system to bill the claim. And they bill the claim outlined within policy of DHS. Processing of the claim is automatic and electronic. Technical assistance is provided to providers on all fee-for-service medical assistance claims and would be in the same manner. So for the person or for the provider, are we concerned?
Person.
So their system, when the process, the bill has some outlines about making sure that folks get the counseling, right, to identify if this makes sense for them. And then if they move to that system, then they would just go to their doctor, and instead of presenting their Blue Cross or their UCare or, you know, their health plan, they would submit their Medicaid white little card that has their PMI number on it, and the provider would bill fee-for-service just like they do for every other fee-for-service provider that, or fee-for-service patient that they serve.
Okay, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just so you don't think there's going to be an impact on DHS at all?
Well, Representative Hicks.
I can't speak to that specifically, but they didn't have any technical assistance of concern at this point.
And let me just say that when we get the fiscal note, we'll have further discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I'm just going to.
That is a missing piece.
And I'm going to call on Representative Ryer, and then we are going to lay the bill over. And as I say, I know, but Representative New Brindley, but I did say before that was going to be the last person. And if you have something really short, but we do need to move on to other bills, and we will be bringing this back. So tell me you just have some short clarification, but we need to move on.
I have a short clarification.
Okay, then I will get to you. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks. I just want to make a comment, actually, so I will cede time to Representative New Brindley, and gladly so. I just want to say that I think that it's great that we have this bill before us. I think that it's essential as we move forward that we are looking at ways to make some structural changes to our healthcare system that benefit groups of people and do it in a way that is something that we can measure later. You spoke of being able to track and maintain, and I appreciate that. I appreciate taking action rather than saying we need to keep studying, we need to keep thinking about it, and delaying change. So I'm just putting in a voice for my support for this piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, the old fiscal note expressed that there's an assumption of about 100,000 people moving over to fee-for-service, which is significant. And DHS has expressed, certainly in other committees, that they have a significant problem with staffing and employees right now. So there is some concern there. My question, though, is I've looked through the bill. Are there qualifying events for when someone has to choose fee-for-service versus the managed care option? Or is this something that can happen outside of the open enrollment period? And if that's the case, what are the assumptions, concerns about churn, you know, moving in and out of this system?
All right. Well, that doesn't seem like a short clarification, but what I'm going to do is ask Representative Hicks to address that and then make her closing comment, and then we're going to lay the bill over. So please go ahead.
Maybe we have more third reading speeches and more questions.
Well, we're going to bring the bill back. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you for the question. So in Medicaid, there isn't an open enrollment period because, as we heard in our other committees, recertification happens on a rotating calendar. So in theory, people could opt in and out. However, what I will tell you is that I don't believe that to be the case. People typically only seek a change when something's not working. And I trust people to use their knowledge of their personal situation, their children's situation, to make the change and make a different choice when that choice is necessary. We've heard a lot today about all of the things that are provided in different systems, are not provided in distant systems, where all the holes in the system exist, and those are all true statements. All this bill does is seek to give the choice to the person to identify which flawed system makes the most sense for them and for their family. That's it. There's all kinds of holes in our healthcare system across the board. We aren't going to fix that with this bill. It's not the goal. The goal of this bill is to put the power in the hands of the people whose health is being affected by who is administering their healthcare program. It is that simple. If you believe people should have the choice to choose what makes sense for their health, this is that bill. I appreciate the committee's willingness to talk. I appreciate all of the diverse perspectives. I did not come to fix the healthcare system today. What I did come to do was create choice for people who are utilizing our system. Thank you so much, committee and chair, and I am happy to see this laid over for further discussion.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Hicks. And the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Next on the agenda, Representative Ryer, House Bill 239. And Representative Ryer moves that House Bill 239 be laid over for possible inclusion. And there is an A1 amendment, and I think, Representative Ryer, is that your amendment, and did you want to move it?
Yes, I'd like to move the A1 amendment, please, Madam Chair.
All right, so Representative Ryer is moving the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she would like to have it discussed. Representative Ryer, did you need to tell us anything about the amendment before we adopt it?
Thank you. No, Madam Chair, I'll address it in my remarks.
All right. So all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So Representative Ryer, to your bill as amended.
All right. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm glad to be here today. I'm here to talk about House File 239, which provides reimbursement for residential pediatric hospice services. While the bill language sounds dry, it's a matter that touches at the most heartfelt need of any family whose child may need these services. As background, in 2016, the legislature passed licensing language in a bipartisan manner that allowed for the first ever hospice, respite, and palliative care center for children in Minnesota. We have one of only three facilities like this in the country. My bill, House File 239, would allow for facilities licensed under this statute to be reimbursed for hospice services through the state's medical assistance program. Here's the issue it solves. The pediatric facility in Minnesota, Crescent Cove, is a home-like setting and is not Medicare certified. That's Medicare certified. Since hospice regulations are generally thought of for adults, the Medicare requirement makes sense for most facilities. But it does not make sense for a facility that serves children with severe and life-limiting conditions. However, this failure to comply with Medicare requirements means that Crescent Cove and any future facilities like it cannot be reimbursed with federal funds. My bill addresses this by authorizing state medical assistance funding to cover these services using Medicare rates. I want to mention up front that we have a fiscal note in process. We did have one last year, which I can comment on if there's interest. But first, I'd like to turn it over to two testifiers who are here today to explain more about the need for this legislation. First, we'll hear from Katie Lindenfelser, who's the founder of Crescent Cove, followed by Carrie Edberg, who will talk about her family's experience. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. So Katie Lindenfelser, please come down. And if Carrie Edberg would please be ready. So, and we're going to ask you to just be pretty brief. So thank you. Welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And thank you, Representative Ryer, for authoring this bill. My name is Katie Lindenfelser. I'm with Crescent Cove. We have Minnesota's only children's hospice and respite care home serving children with complex chronic medical conditions. And part of our care is for respite, for short stays that are between 3 and 7 days in length for a family to have a short break. And the other part of our care is for end-of-life care and having a sacred option other than the family's home or hospital when a child is dying. There are many other options for adults who are dying. And this is the only other option outside of the hospital or home for a child and a family to be cared for. And we serve a number of children and their families at Crescent Cove when their child is dying. And there are no out-of-pocket costs to the families who come to Crescent Cove, which is a model around the world. In our country, as Representative Ryer said, we are only the third home like this. And it's really due to the lack of a reimbursement and funding and payment model to support the sustainability. In England, there are 54 children's hospice and respite homes that we're modeled after. And so the need is great. We have thousands of children who die in our state every year. And we thank you for hearing this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And now we have Carrie Edberg. Please come down and welcome. And please go ahead and introduce yourself and give us your remarks.
Hi, my name is Carrie Edberg, and I totally support Crescent Cove and wish there were more places that are open. So I had two children that were medically complex, Milo and Leo, and they have attended Crescent Cove for respite. The only time I get a break for my children is when they're in the hospital. Usually they're ill, and I'm driving back and forth from home to the hospital. So Crescent Cove provides a place, it's like a mini vacation for the children to go. They get lots of therapy there, lots of one-on-one, and allows me and my other children to get a little break. This past October, sorry, my son Leo passed away.
Oh.
He was 8. I knew his health was declining. And so I was trying to figure out to have him pass away at home or Crescent Cove. And I had talked to my older boys, and it was determined that Crescent Cove was probably the best place for him to pass. And I had called Crescent Cove to set it up, and we were kind of setting it up. And then on a Friday, he started having seizures that just we could not stop. So I called Crescent Cove, and I said, look, I don't know how much longer he has. So they were able to get us in on Monday. And with them, we were able to control his seizures. We were able to decrease his pain. This was something I probably couldn't do at home because it was lots of calls to the doctors, new medications that were being carried over quickly to give to him. While we were there, they gave support to me. They gave support to my other children. They helped watch my other children so I could spend time with Leo. And on Wednesday, he passed. They provided us time to just stay with him. They gave us time to cuddle, to say our goodbyes. There was no rush. They did a beautiful honor walk with him when he had to be wheeled out. The stuff they provided for me and my children is something I can never repay. After going through this, there's no way I could imagine doing this in my house by myself. And I didn't want to be in a hospital setting because we spend a lot of our lives in the hospital setting. So having Crescent Cove in this beautiful area and all these staff there to provide care for our family was just greatly needed. And I, like I said, this place needs to be supported. They need to get reimbursed for what they do because it is life-altering for us families who have lost children. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your testimony. Thank you for making the effort. It's not easy to come down here with your child and sit and wait, and we really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
And we're so sorry for your loss. So those are the two testifiers on the list. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Not seeing anyone. So Representative Ryer, closing comments. And again, I should note that this also is going to be laid over because we don't yet have a current fiscal note. And, but, right, Ms., right. So what we're expect that I, probably, hopefully soon. So Representative Ryer.
Were there any, Madam Chair, any questions from the committee?
Sorry, I didn't ask that, did I? I'm kind of in a hurry here, but let me, all right. Well, I didn't see anyone on the list, so, all right, Representative Nadeau.
I'm going to go really fast, Madam Chair. And my question is Crescent Cove, are they an unlicensed facility? Is that why they can't tap Medicare? Are they licensed under 144?
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question, Representative Nadeau. It isn't about being licensed for that. The issue is things like the width of the hallways, which were designed for, it's a home-like setting. It's not adult Medicare compliant, the physical structure, because you have to have wider hallways, and I know that you could say more, but it's not a question of safety and quality of care. It's these really specific characteristics.
And Ms. Linden-Felser.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. We are licensed, Crescent Cove is licensed as a residential hospice, and so this bill would impact any residential hospice caring for children at the end of life. But children don't access Medicare, so there's no Medicare reimbursement for them.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Yeah, and thank you for asking that. When I first learned about the issue, I had the same kinds of questions, so appreciate that. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Ryer, I'm looking at lines 2.3, excuse me, and 2.4, and it says that the payments must be made from state funds, though the commissioner must seek to obtain federal financial participation. Those two musts feel like they are a little bit in conflict to me. Is the intention of this that the feds would potentially pick up some of these costs? Because it says that it must be made from state funds.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley. I'll let DHS comment on that if they wish, but this is the kind of thing that we're also looking forward to the future and other possible facilities. If a facility were able to obtain federal funds, then we would, of course, want them to if they were designed with that ability in mind. So I wouldn't want to limit the requirement to first go for federal funds if it's an option. Does that clarify?
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryer. I wonder then if that language needs to be cleaned up a little bit, because right now it says that it must be made from state funds, and I wonder if we would want to clean that up and say, if federal funds are not available, then it must be if we want to clean that up a little bit. I think
We can talk.
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley, happy to take that to talk through and take it to the lawyers and get something that's as clear and specific as possible.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. So I have no other members on the list. So Representative Ryer, closing comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. To me, this is a matter of looking out for people who are in one of the most traumatic situations I can imagine as a parent, and I hope that we'll have your support in helping them in this time of need. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, and thank you to the testifiers. Next bill is House File 384, which is, again, Representative Ryer. So Representative Ryer moves that House File 384 be laid over for possible inclusion. And there is no amendment on the bill that I see. So Representative Ryer to House File 384.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Now we'll talk about House File 384. This is a bill that removes barriers to access to diagnosis and treatment for rare diseases. This bill is important as we all want to ensure that all Minnesotans are able to fully benefit from the excellent healthcare facilities here in Minnesota and even elsewhere in the United States when needed. But currently, too many people with conditions that are difficult to diagnose and treat experience delays that affect their ability to receive the care they need. Many of these people are children. House File 384 is a nuanced piece of legislation which I've been working on for the past 2 years. We've had very constructive feedback from all stakeholders, including health plans, providers, state agencies, other members of the legislature, and of course patients and their families. As a result, the bill looks very different than it did at the beginning, providing the access patients need while putting up sensible guardrails. We're continuing to fine-tune the language and also have a new fiscal note in process. But briefly, this bill establishes that health plan companies may not restrict access to providers related to the diagnosis, monitoring, and treatment of a rare disease or condition. It creates specific conditions under which a person will qualify as having a rare disease, including an undiagnosed rare disease, and provides guidelines for cost sharing for these out-of-network providers. In your packet, you'll find a number of letters with support from, including the major healthcare, many of the major healthcare systems in our state, and I encourage you to have a look at those. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to our testifiers, and we'll look forward to your questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. So Ann St. Martin is the first person on my list. Welcome to the committee. And because we're kind of running behind, we're going to have to really ask you to please be brief, and we're going to have to be a little more restrictive on the time. I'm sorry about that, but anyway, we're going to lay the bill over.
I talk really fast, too.
All right. Welcome, and please state your name.
Good morning. Good morning, members of the committee and Representative Lieby. My name is Ann St. Martin, and I'm from Invergrove Heights, Minnesota, where I live with my husband and my two sons. My son, Leo, is 6 years old, and he has a rare genetic disease called Pompe disease. I'm going to share with you today just one of our insurance struggles dealing with our child and his rare disease needs. Leo's Pompe disease diagnosis came about after he almost died. We had seen our pediatrician for feeding issues early on at 3 months. She ordered labs. Everything came back normal. But as he continued to get worse, she advised that we go see a pediatric neurologist. But first, we needed to wait for prior authorization from our insurance company to get able to see that neurologist. As I watched my baby get weaker and weaker, I knew I couldn't wait the 3 to 6 weeks it would take to get insurance approval. So on top of that, and also on top of that, if you wait, there is a limited number of specialists available for you to see. So you wait 3 to 6 weeks for your prior authorization, and then you wait about 4 weeks to get an actual appointment. I called the doctor's office. I told them that we would pay out of pocket, and they told me it would be about $5,000 or more for the visit. They also told me that after the prior authorization came in, they could not go back and refund me. Luckily, my husband and I were able to do that. So we got an appointment, another grace of God, by the next day. We took the appointment, we prayed, and I remember checking in, giving my credit card to the receptionist and thinking, this is it, we're going to get the answers we need, Leo's going to be okay, everything's going to be fine. But instead, the doctor came into the room, she looked him over, listened to his heart, told us she was calling an ambulance and checking us into the hospital. When he got to the hospital, they did an EKG, they saw that his heart was two-thirds the size of his chest and he was in respiratory failure. We were rushed to emergency surgery the first night. They stabilized his heart. They put in a G-tube for feeding and later on a trach for him to breathe. And we waited. 2 weeks later, still in the hospital, waiting for expensive genetic labs to come back, which we also paid out of pocket for, we were given the official diagnosis of Pompe disease. It's a rare disease, but it's also one of the lucky ones because there is a treatment. The treatment is an enzyme replacement therapy. It costs about $600,000 a year. The hospital advised us we needed to call our insurance right away, get prior authorization, and get on medical assistance. Luckily, because Leo was so bad, they were able to do some infusion medical treatments under the life-saving measures plan. But they said anything past a month would need a prior auth. So more begging our insurance for approval, asking doctors to submit documents while my son lay in a hospital bed getting weaker and weaker. It finally took 6 weeks for them to approve the recommended dose. We were in the hospital for a total of 4 months until Leo was strong enough to come home. I know today that we are one of the lucky families. We had good private PPO insurance when we entered the hospital. We were able to afford thousands and thousands of dollars of out-of-pocket expenses to be seen quickly, which literally saved his life. We were told later on by one of his doctors that if we would have had waited for that initial neurologist appointment for 6 to 8 weeks, that he would have died of heart failure at home. So just think of waking up to your dead child in his crib because you're waiting on a stranger to sign a piece of paper that your doctor says you need to see another doctor. We're lucky because he was so sick that the hospital could get around some of the insurance barriers and treat him under the life-saving treatment measure plan. We were lucky because we were physically located in that hospital. We had access to doctors daily. We could bother them, get them to submit documents. But the person who wasn't lucky was Leo. In those 4 to 6 months while we waited for appointments, diagnosis, and medicine, he lost the ability to walk. The glycogen had built up in his outer skeletal muscles, taking away many of the things that six-year-olds today can do. Today he's in a wheelchair. He requires intense therapies to be able to sit up, dress himself, and do most things kids his age can do. We did apply for medical assistance through the TEPFR program. So we have a secondary insurance that helps us when our primary insurance will deny treatment. If insurance barriers for rare disease children were not so complicated in the state would save money in the long run. If you invest early at getting these kids proper diagnosis, treatment, you will have healthier patients who need less assistance from the state. If you invest and you give them access early on, you save their life and many times stop the development of permanent symptoms. You would save money on the cost of families like myself who have to apply to the medical assistance program even when we have primary coverage because our primary coverage denies treatment. The state would save money by getting these patients treated and diagnosed early, which slow the disease progression and the need for facility care and nursing support, long-term hospitalizations. So as a parent and a citizen, I'm asking you to support this legislation. I want the rare disease kids who come after Leo to have access to a knowledgeable provider. I don't want financial standing of a family to determine how long you have to wait to save your sick kid.
I have to ask you to wrap up.
Okay. And most importantly, I don't want insurance companies to not stand in the way of a child's life because it needs a prior authorization. So thank you for your support of HF 384.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Dr. Tim Fema. And so that was about 5 minutes, and we need to be really brief. So, Dr. Fema, I'm so sorry to do this to testifiers because you have very compelling things to say, but we do need to. We have another bill after this one, so welcome and please state your name.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. My name is Tim Fema. I'm a child neurologist at Gillette Children's in St. Paul, and I'm fourth generation sandstone in Pine County too, but that's not here today. I'm child neurologist at Gillette Children's. I'm the medical director there. I care for thousands of kids and adults with rare diseases. I'm also a double agent because I'm a parent of one special needs kid in my house with a rare genetic syndrome. So this is a community that I care deeply about. I'm going to comment on two things and try to keep it succinct. The first is I like House File 384 because it sort of helps shorten the diagnostic odyssey. The average time the diagnosis is long. It hurts that patients have to wait to see me. My diagnostic odyssey with my daughter took 8 years. So it doesn't it happens to physicians' kids as well. And some patients are waiting long periods of time. I do clinics in the last 2 weeks. I've been in physically in St. Cloud and physically in Mankato. And I, with the advent of virtual care, I go everywhere from War Road down to, you know, just every community, every clinic. If we can shorten the diagnostic time, this is important because this leads to my second point, which is that as Ann St. Martin just mentioned, there are a lot of developing rare gene therapies, disease-specific therapies that, if delayed, can harm the child. The thought that a Pompe child has to wait for enzyme replacement and lose more skills than needed to is pretty catastrophic. We're getting better at that, but we can be better at that yet. And so for those two reasons, I support House File 384, quicker, earlier diagnosis, and then it's better access to care. And there is not equal division of experts in these conditions. So I do some specific research in rare conditions. I know my partners at Mayo who do rare condition research. I know patients at the partners at the Mayo. We all know each other, and we send each other the patients that need to be in the right spot. We sort them to where they need to be because we're not all experts of all rare disease. There is geographical divisions in who does what expertly. So for that, I'm open to more questions. I hope that was succinct enough, but thank you for your time.
That was great. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. And we have Sheila Grabowski. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Sheila Grabowski. I live in Apple Valley. I'm a constituent of Robert Bierman. I want to thank you, first of all, for the opportunity to speak today on this. When you look at me, I look like a normal person. But I do have a rare disease. And I have what's called neurogenic thoracic outlet syndrome. It is defined as being rare by NIH. I also talked to my surgeon this past week through messaging to let them know that I was going to be speaking on this, and I sent them the bill. First of all, insurance companies and medical facilities, don't let them kid you. They are out to make money. And it's unfortunate when they put money before patients' care and needs. Now, neurogenic thoracic outlet syndrome, it's NTOS, if any of you want to look it up. I have actually all the documents here that was published by my surgeon, Dr. Robert Thompson, down in St. Louis, Missouri. He actually wrote the medical textbook. In 2008 to 2013, I was shuffled from doctor to doctor to doctor to doctor to specialist as my disease progressed on. It started out as massive chest pains. I thought I was having a heart attack. I went to the ER. That was all clear. I ended up with neurologists, orthopedists, GI specialists. All within those years, they could not figure out what was wrong with me. In March of 2013, I went back to my primary care doctor, and thank God, he believed me with what was going on. We sat down, went over all the symptoms, and the last symptom I told him was tingling in my ring finger and pinky. Classic sign of TOS. He goes, I know what it is. He said, but we have nobody in the state of Minnesota who can help you. The person who has it has, or that was doing thoracic outlet syndrome, has retired and has is incapable of being able to help you. We as a team need to find somebody. I went online. There are, at that time, there were only 5 specialists in the United States that handled neurogenic thoracic outlet syndrome. And he was a vascular surgeon. The closest one was in St. Louis, Missouri. Now I believe there are 8 total in the United States that work with patients with what I have. I did have surgery in 2013 where they removed my first rib and opened up and decompressed my area in the brachial plexus here. And they also did a pec minor release, which opened up the area for the nerves to flow freely. I had to have resurgery. I had it last September. I exhausted all my options. I had to fight tooth and nail, not the first time around, with the insurance company since 2018. And I ended up needing surgery again because I lost the ability to go in for trigger point injections every 6 weeks. The medical facility and insurance company that I work with told me that they don't deem TPIs, trigger point injections, as a medical solution. I ended up having to upgrade on my pain medication, and I also had to upgrade on going to physical therapy once a week. Had I had opportunities without begging and pleading to get trigger point injections every 6 weeks, I don't think I'd be on the opioid dose I am today, and I also don't think I would have had to have surgery again. So I'm going to end there, but I just want to let you know that this bill is significant to people like me. And I appreciate, Representative Liebling, your time with the intractable pain bill last year. You were so gracious in responding back and forth to me during a pretentious time when you guys were going back and forth with it. And I appreciate your support and Robert Bierman's support as well.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We have Representative New Brindley on the list, and then we're going to I'll let Representative Murphy, and then we're going to lay the bill over. So, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry.
I have 34 documents, pages of documents. I told Josh.
Okay.
We're not going to do that. If anybody wants to look at it or talk to me, please.
Okay, thank you very much. And you know what, I'm sorry, Representative New Brindley, I should ask first if there's anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill. Okay, not seeing anyone. Sorry about that. Go ahead, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just trying to make sure I understand how the different pieces of the bill interact. And it looks like under paragraph B that that specifically relates to sort of the diagnostic process, and there's this 60-day window where they need to move into a qualified in-network person, and then after that this this bill wouldn't apply if they don't actually have a diagnosis of a rare disease. But then my question is, once they do have that diagnosis, it says no health plan company may restrict the choice of an enrollee. And my question is, would this then apply? You know, I mean, I spoke to the folks at Children's, and I really appreciate that. Frankly, I have a brother who spent half his childhood at Children's Hospital. So I really appreciate, in theory. My question, though, and my concern would be, and maybe there is additional stuff that we could do, my concern would be, would this then allow a patient to choose, let's say they've heard about a facility in California that they think would be really great, even though we do have options here in Minnesota at Gillette or Children's, would this language require that that the insurance companies would pay for those services in California, for example, even if they were acceptable here in the state?
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, Representative Brindley. Yes, and there is language that controls the cost sharing. So one, you know, in theory, then it wouldn't matter to the health plan because they wouldn't be paying a different level of cost for those services if someone went out of network in California or out of network in Minnesota. They're still, for these conditions under these limited circumstances, are allowed to go out of network. So I hear your question, but I don't see a practical concern. Happy to talk it through more offline, though.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps I misunderstand the cost sharing. My understanding is that the cost sharing would limit the patient's responsibility via coinsurance, copayments, whatever that may be. And perhaps this isn't, maybe this is a question for the health plans, and maybe they have no interest in getting involved here. But can our laws govern what happens in California? I mean, if California bills, are they bound by Minnesota statute to only pay what our statute allows?
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. We'll want to talk through that. I have worked closely with the health plans, and we've worked through a number of issues, specifically with Mr. Andreessen and his team. So that concern has not been specifically talked through. We'll take that on.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Reverend Ryer. I just wanted to just add a story just to, in support of this bill. My family had trouble with seizures, so I have five kids, and three of the five had seizures. And my oldest boy, when he was seven, we got a lot of local opinions about his seizures, and basically they said he would grow out of them, and we just got a lot of different options. But it was great to have Mayo because we found our way to Mayo. It was a little bit of a process to get there. We didn't know that when we got there. They said, no, anybody can come to Mayo. But it was a little difficult to get there. He was always medicated. Mayo said when we got there, they said, thank you for bringing him here. He was 7 years old, and his roommate at the hospital was a 20-year-old, and his conditions were a lot different. He struggled every day with his seizures. So we got treatment there. We had world-class diagnostic. We had world-class surgeon. We had the top-rated surgeon in the world, and I just want to say that that treatment stopped his seizures, and today he's a mechanical engineer with SpaceX. So anyway, it's great. I like what you're doing here, and I think we need to be able to take those options when, especially in this kind of case, for sure.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Representative Ryer. Final word on the bill, and we're going to lay it over.
Yeah. First of all, Representative, thanks for sharing your family story, and it's wonderful to hear such a good outcome. I would just encourage everyone to come to me with questions. We are still in the stage of working through details with the agency, with the health plans, and we want this to be an excellent bill because it's an excellent purpose and it needs to get done. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And with that, House File 384 is laid over for possible inclusion. And our final bill is Representative Akam, House File 390. And Representative Aiken's motion is going to be that House File 390 be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Finance and Policy. So with that, and then there is an amendment, the A2 amendment, and I just wanted to see if members check your packet if you want to look at the amendment just to make sure you have it, because I think it may have been in some packets, but maybe not all. So you should have it. Let us know if you do not. And so I think Representative Aiken wanted to move adoption of the A2. Is that correct, Representative Aiken? Is there anything you want to tell us about the A2 before we adopt it? Do you need to tell us, or is that just put it in the shape you want to have it discussed?
Just put the bill in the shape that we want to consider, and we can talk about it in terms.
All right.
Whole bill, I think.
Very good. So Representative Aiken is moving the A2. Any discussion? All right. All those in favor of adoption of the A2, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. So to your bill as amended, Representative Aiken.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 390 is a patient-focused bill that is designed to ensure, complete breast cancer screening that promotes early diagnosis and ultimately saves lives. Here's what we know. 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer at some point in their lives. And in fact, it's the most common form of cancer in women. And we also know that breast cancer is not limited to just women, and that many men are diagnosed as well. Treatment and survival rates for breast cancer have advanced over the last many years, and in large part due to early diagnosis. The importance of early detection is reflected in the requirement by the Affordable Care Act to include breast cancer screening as an essential health benefit at no cost to patients. The goal of this federal provision is to increase early detection, lower cancer treatment costs, and to save lives. The only problem is that for a small percentage of people, the initial mammogram is inconclusive and doesn't say if there is a problem or if there's not. Those patients need additional testing to determine if they need to be concerned or not, and those additional tests can often and do come with large copays to patients that can range from several hundred dollars to $1,000. These copays become a barrier to care and potentially a delay in diagnosis, which we know can negatively impact the survival rates of breast cancer. In fact, treating advanced cancer is often much more expensive, coupled with reduced rates of survival. As a breast cancer survivor myself, I know firsthand how important early diagnosis is, and I want to ensure that all patients have the opportunity to the positive outcomes that I experienced. I just want to touch briefly on the A2 amendment. It was brought to me before the Commerce Committee hearing that we had a couple weeks ago, and it's to address the unfortunate interaction between state and federal law. So it impacts the small percentage of a high deductible plans that have health savings accounts and that receive a preferred tax treatment under the federal tax code. In order to remain eligible for that tax treatment, the plan has to charge cost sharing for certain services. So that particular small percentage of people would be exempt from the provisions of House File 390 until their deductible has been met. Okay. So I want to point out that this bill has been introduced several times. It has gone through the Department of Commerce analysis about mandates, and it was decided that it was not a mandate, but in fact a clarification of existing benefits, and that in that report it was determined that the potential of harm is low and the potential of benefit is moderate because of that early diagnosis. And so with that, I have a couple of testifiers, and I think there's others who want to testify.
All right. And just to note, we're close to our ending time. We really need to try to end on time. We can go a few minutes over, but I really would like us to try to end. And just to say, members, you have the fiscal note. The fiscal note makes note of the concern that was just fixed with the amendment. So, right? That's,
yes.
That's
yep.
Right. Okay. Very good. So, with that, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Amy Koch. I'm here on behalf of Susan G. Komen. Thank you for your time, and I'm here to support House File 390. My Aunt Laura tells the story of visiting my great-grandmother And they were getting dressed one morning, and she noticed deep scars across my grandmother's chest, and she asked, great-grandmother's chest, and she asked her, you know, and a kid, what is that? And my great-grandmother answered, that's so I can spend more time with you. What my great-grandmother did not know is that the scars ran much deeper than that. The scars would run on her daughter, my grandmother, when she passed away. The scars would run on her granddaughter, my mother, when she died at 64 in 2012. And those scars would be on her great-granddaughter, my sister, after her double mastectomy. However, the good news is my sister caught hers early, and the double mastectomy was preventative, and we were hoping to end this era of scars in my family. An estimated 16% of women screened with modern digital mammography will require follow-up imaging. House File 390 ensures that those women have the required diagnostic screening covered. Family history, anomalies, dense breast tissue, or a previous bout with breast cancer are all reasons that they might need a deeper diagnosis. The Department of Commerce, as you stated, has evaluated this and said it is not a mandate, but simply a clarification. 2 years ago, I had an abnormal initial screening, my second. My family history and body makeup required diagnostic screening. After the ultrasound, I received a bill for over $800. I called my insurance company thinking that I'd been wrongfully billed because screening is covered, and I was told that I only get the initial. For me, this was a surprise, an annoyance, and expensive. For many women, they may not be able to afford the additional screening, and they might skip the very important screening. I have seen the cost and devastation associated with misdetection up close and personal. The tens of thousands of dollars spent on my mom's double mastectomy and the subsequent chemo and radiation. A second round of chemo and radiation because the cancer had already moved to her lymph nodes. Thousands of dollars on a brain scan and the doctor's appointment where the physician told me your mom's brain is full of cancer. Then the money spent on the hospice nurses, the bed, the equipment, and every other day delivery of drugs because mom couldn't speak and I had to make sure that she had enough so she wasn't suffering. But early detection saves those medical costs. Early detection saves pain and suffering. And early detection saves lives. I would ask the members to support House File 390 and help people spend more time with the ones they love.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Dan Andreessen. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. I won't cover my talking points that are in your packets. There's a letter there that kind of talks about operationally how this will work. Regarding which markets this will be applied to, but also how this will kind of alter premiums and cost sharing in those markets. We do have some kind of questions as to the scope of the bill, which we've shared with Representative Akam. Right now it just says any additional diagnostic services, so we just would like to have some clarification as to what that would be. So once, if this is enacted, how we code this to make sure that this follows correctly. Also, just want to be clear, because I think there's been some confusion in other committees, is these are covered services. So that's kind of the first question, is everything that's in this bill is covered. So the second question is, the medical bills that come from those radiologists, how do those get paid, whether it's premium, all premiums, or a little bit of premium and then cost sharing? I think that's what the bill is looking to address, is moving it all to premium. So just making that clear. And then also just want to address a statement that was in a letter in your packets from Radius Radiology, where it's that's a radiology clinic here in Minnesota that's owned by a private equity firm out in New York City. In their letter, they say, more than ever, we must work to eliminate barriers to care, and patient inability to pay should not prevent them from obtaining potential life-saving, cost-saving early diagnosis. We completely agree with that statement. Cost should not be a barrier to care. And if Reyes Radiology and others folks believe that, the best way that they can solve the problem of patients affording their care is lowering their costs. Nothing in their letter states anything about them lowering their costs, and we'd hope that as this bill moves forward, they can find ways from their end to address the situation. Thank you.
Thank you. So is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, welcome. And yeah, please be very brief. We are actually over time now, so yes. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Shaniqua James, and I am a program director and a clinical social worker for Gilda's Club Twin Cities. For those of you who are not familiar with Gilda's, we are a local nonprofit that serves people who are impacted by cancer. I've written out my testimony here, so I will be brief. Although Gilda serves people with all cancers, a large majority of our members have a diagnosis of breast cancer and a story about the barriers they have faced in getting appropriate testing after an initial mammogram. A member who I'll refer to as Tina shared her story about how her original diagnosis of breast cancer was delayed because she could not afford to get the recommended follow-up testing after having an initial mammogram. This was a very preventable delay that led to Tina's late diagnosis and delayed cancer treatment. Another member who we'll refer to as Janice talked about having to sell her home and move in with her children just to afford her medical bills associated with testing after an initial mammogram as well. The commonality in both of these stories is how the costs associated with diagnostic services and testing snowballed into a health and financial crisis for those who are a part of our most vulnerable populations. In addition, the lack of coverage for these services creates a disparity within minority communities that are impacted most by breast cancer with high rates of diagnoses, late diagnoses, and mortality. This cost burden is not exclusive to minority communities, but also is highly impactful to our rural Minnesota communities who are already experiencing large disparities within cancer health access. This bill has the potential to aid in eliminating these health disparities by increasing accessibility with covering these costs and allowing the Tinas and the Janices of Minnesota to focus on their cancer journey and recovery instead of the burden of paying for it, and also giving access to early diagnosis, which then will not delay care. I truly believe that it is the duty of all of us to ensure individuals who are already facing stressful and life-changing circumstances are not burdened with making this decision to either pay for services or have life-saving services. This is no decision that any Minnesotan should have to face. I urge the members of this committee to help pass this important legislation.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Okay. We have one comment or question from Representative Bonner.
I'll try to be brief. I just wanted to say thank you for this bill and want to say that I will tell you, as someone who had my own family history come crashing into my reality earlier this year, you know, the rumors of my family were prevalent around what happened. And in fact, my great aunt had both of her breasts removed in a time when diagnosis and treatment were not well known. They didn't know if it was cancer. They simply took the precaution to remove them both. And earlier this year, I also had a screening and was told that I needed to come in immediately to have an ultrasound. And I can tell you the things that went through my mind were incredibly difficult to face. And family history came crashing back. Fortunately, I am being told that what they've seen is something just to be monitored and not at this time an issue of concern. But I think this bill and my fears from my own experience are something that are repeated by women across the state, across the country, and we know that this is preventable, that this can be addressed. We have medicine that can fix this. So I want to thank you for this bill. I want to thank you for making sure that we have that necessary next step to catch things early and to address it when it still can be. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Final word, Representative Akam.
Thank you for the comments, and I really appreciate the testifiers coming in and sharing their stories. And I just ask for your support as we refer this to Stakeout.
All right. Thank you. So Representative Akam renews her motion that House File 390, as amended, be re-referred to the State Government Committee. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.